Welcome, everyone. This is Louis Schwartzberg. I'm a filmmaker, and this is a podcast called Wonder and Awe, A Journey into the Soul. As a filmmaker, I love to take audiences on journeys through time and scale, making the invisible visible. With Fantastic Fungi, we did a deep dive underground to learn about the mycelial network and how that wisdom can be shared above the ground, which we did with Gratitude Revealed. I'd like to thank the Fetzer Institute for supporting this podcast. I'm really honored to have Michelle Sciotta, Lonnie, as we know her, who is an associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University and the director of ASU Substance Use and Addiction Translational Research Network. She received her bachelor's degree from Stanford University and her doctorate in social and personality psychology from UC Berkeley. Her research investigates the human emotional experience with a focus on awe, emotional regulation, close relationships, and emotion-related mechanisms of behavior change. Welcome, Lonnie, to our podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much, Louis.
I'm just jazzed to talk to you this morning. Someone who shares my passion for wonder and awe and explores it from, you know, the beautiful science of, gratitude and the stuff that, you know, Dacher and you have explored. I know a lot at UC Berkeley. I mean, I'm just grateful that science is doing a deep dive into it, because as a filmmaker, I'm turned on by wonder, you know, and I think that wonder is the intersection between art and science. We're both trying to figure out what is reality, what is this world, you know, and there's a more structured way of perhaps telling this grand story of what is life. And then the artistic one has a little more creative latitude. And I think it's beautiful that the two can come together and help us all try to understand, you know, basically how to be present, right, in a way. And so what turned, you know, you on to explore it as well from a scientific perspective?
So really interesting question. And as you mentioned, it is a great place where it's a great space to explore for scientists who are also artists. And that's very much how I define myself. I was trained pretty intensively in the performing arts growing up. Music, dance, literature, poetry, the theater have always been a very important part of my well-being, both as a consumer and as a performing artist. And so that was such a deep part of my sense of self, sense of well-being. And so much of it was rooted in the opportunity that you get through those media to experience something new, something transcendent. And it can be anything from seeing the world through another's eyes to seeing the universal in the specific, right? When you relate deeply to a character's experience and language and poetry in Shakespeare, you are crossing centuries and an ocean, still within Western culture. But I've had similar experiences reading work from other cultural contexts as well, that reminds you that granting all of the vast differences in cultures that we grow up with, there are some common experiences that we share, and that can be very powerful and humanizing. To the sheer complexity and structure that the arts can present, and here I'm thinking particularly of music and dance, in such a way that the training that I have in both of those fields in many ways allows me to appreciate the extraordinary when it happens. So all of those, to me, really are readily encapsulated in the emotional experience that we call awe. So when I started working with Dacher as a graduate student in the late 1990s and studying emotion and studying the theoretical approach to emotion that defines emotions as distinct functional states, I was genuinely shocked to find that nobody had ever studied awe. I mean, nobody. I mean, not a single empirical paper on this state that seemed to me to be at least potentially a cornerstone of a healthy psychological life. So that was really, for me, what made me so excited about this endeavor and quite determined, actually, to continue pursuing it.
Well, it seems like when you experience wonder, you know, time stands still and it gets you closer to the divine. I mean, why do you think we have a need for that, you know?
Let's put it this way. I'm not sure I would call it a need in the same way that I would call our need for human connection a need. The need for human connection is one that, if unfulfilled, leads to profound physical and psychological damage. It's why isolation is a punishment in most known societies, right? I think that awe is an opportunity, and an opportunity that, for the most part, enriches us greatly. Why do we have that opportunity? It has a lot to do with some somewhat distinctive properties of how the human mind works. We are the information animal. We have dominated this planet, and I use that word very advisedly. We have come to inhabit almost every part of this planet successfully, and to outperform any other species, not in terms of numbers necessarily, but in terms of our ability to adjust and adapt to pretty much any situation. And that comes down to how we process information and our ability to store information, to test out possibilities in our minds without having to commit to action. That really comes from the ability to store information. And the consequence is that both storing information and working with stored information and assuming that stored information applies to the current moment is really crucial to human success. But at the same time, the ability to recognize when you need to stop using your stored information and take in what's novel and unexpected and important in your current environment is really crucial. And when we talk about the emotional experience of awe, there's a lot of support for the proposal that that's what's going on, that freezing in time, that sense of detachment from your normal day-to-day concerns, that sense that time has stopped and you are completely mindfully immersed in the moment, is your mind recognizing that what I have learned before does not sufficiently account for what I'm seeing right now. And what I'm seeing right now is big enough and important enough that it's worth trying to comprehend. And for our brains, trying to comprehend means take in as much information you can. Just start sucking up, you know, what's going on out there into the sponge that is our mind. And then we'll deal with processing that later.
That's great. I mean, you know, when I go out to my camera, I'm looking to be turned on in that way, you know, to be able to let go of all the preconceived notions, like film itself, having a blank slate to be able to receive any kind of sensory input that triggers your emotion, you know, and then dwell on it. Because then momentarily, you know, I think what I do and what people do, then we categorize it. Okay, oh, it's a flower. Oh, it's a rose. Oh, isn't it beautiful? But what I try to do is try to go beyond that, because that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean you know the essence of the rose. I try to like let go and say, okay, why is it turning me on? Why do I want to zoom into those petals? What is it about the shape and the composition and the color and the aroma and the entire sensory experience of smelling a rose? What's really happening, you know? And absorbing it as an emotion and not as a thought.
It's a terrific example, because when you look at a rose, as you're, say, walking down the street, right, you look at a rose and you think, that's a rose. Or you don't even think, your mind just goes, yep, rose. What that enables the mind to do is kind of cross off the need to pay any more attention to it. That's a rose. I know roses. I got roses. It's not urgent in the moment, right? And so we don't have to engage with this rose in a unique way. And again, it's very easy to disparage that from the perspective of a modern, urban, reasonably materially well-off, right, safe and secure perspective. Why would I ever turn down the opportunity to be 100% in the moment? Well, we have to, again, apply what we have learned in order to make it through the day. And the simple truth is we actually can't stop and smell every rose, because if we do, we're never going to get to work. We're never going to get anything done, right? That is not a realistic goal. I like to manage expectations around this. However, you know, we get so locked into getting through the day and getting everything done that those opportunities to look at this rose and thereby notice something about this rose, the shading of colors on the petals, that can be extraordinary, the way in which this rose is extraordinary, we can pass those opportunities by very easily.
Right. Yeah. But you know, look, obviously it's a balance, but I would say it's like way out of balance. I would say that most people spend almost 100% of their time in functional consciousness, going from task to task to task. And when that's why I got the cliche of, why don't you, like, was it, you know, slow down and smell the roses? You know, I mean, even like 5 seconds, a 3 second break in your day that you're saying, inhale that aroma and just kind of kick back and really experience it and not just blow past it. As you said, oh, it's a rose and I put it in the cubby hole where it belongs and I'm just moving on. To be able to soak it up.
Yeah, I have a lot of compassion for that. I mean, I'm just going constantly. It just never stops. There's a meme going around right now in my field of, you know, being an academic is just saying day after day, oh, next week things will settle down and I'll get some proper work done. I don't know who said that first, but it's genius because it's absolutely true. So we just, you know, my life also is just flinging from task to task at most waking hours. What I do find is that making the time to open the door up to awe is very rewarding and often helps to remind me of what I enjoy and what is rewarding in life. I was talking with a friend and colleague last night, Wendy Mendez, about psychological well-being and the rich and growing movement to understand it more deeply and help people achieve it and really doing that with rigorous science. One of the things that we were talking about is that a lot of the work on well-being, and especially the work on well-being focused interventions, tends to focus on reducing distress rather than increasing the positive aspects of well-being. Now, there are absolutely exceptions to that. So my friend and colleague, Sonia Lubomirsky, does gratitude interventions. And so she's one of a handful of folks who really are taking very seriously this notion that well-being is not just the absence of distress. It's the presence of something that enriches us psychologically and emotionally. But we need a lot more of that. And I think that practices related to awe have the opportunity to bring us into that more mindful, present, and growing space. One thing that's a little different between awe and at least what most of us in the West think of as mindfulness is that awe is centering and it's presence. It should also be challenging. It should also, again, provide an opportunity to ask questions about the nature of the world, of the universe, of humanity, of Roses, right, that acknowledge that we don't know everything. That can put us into a place where we can enrich, or at least a direction in which we can enrich becomes more salient. And I think a lot of us would benefit from that. And I certainly would. And I think most people I know could use a little bit of a nudge to get out of that complacent space.
If we have to acknowledge we don't know everything, if you can like let go and say, yes, it's a mystery, and I'm, you know, unveiling the mystery is the joy in my life. You know, and that's just, and I love it. Which goes back to what I said earlier about having your brain is like a blank slate of film, open mm-hmm. to anything. Yeah. We don't have to have preconceived ideas of where it came from and who made it and what religion and any of that stuff. That would be that feeds your soul.
Yeah, people have greater and lesser degrees of comfort with that. I want to acknowledge that, you know, I mean, I'm an awe junkie, right? So, and I'm a learning junkie. I love to hear a song I've never heard before and go, okay, that's different, right? I love to read an op-ed in the paper that actually presents a perspective that is different from my own that I haven't heard before. That's exciting, right? I like the moment of ambiguity when I am looking at a sunset or staring at the stars in the night sky, which I've seen, I haven't seen sunsets or the night sky, and I know what they are and how they work. But when I look at them, I am reminded of how much I don't know mm-hmm. and how little I am relative to all of the forces that are out there determining is probably an overstatement, but influencing every outcome that I care about. Now, on one hand, for me, I'm usually trying to control things one way or another, that's actually a huge relief to recognize that smallness and powerlessness for a moment. There are people for whom that's terrifying, and that's okay. And those people tend to be a little less awe prone. That's cool too. But certainly for many of us, the sense of awe and wonder is accompanied by, and we actually have some new data that are pointing in this direction, a sense of beauty. And that's interesting. Why is it that we perceive the extraordinary also as beautiful? And what does that mean about what is beautiful to us?
Well, you struck my main passion in life. I mean, capturing beauty is what I do. But again, like people can stop at a superficial level and go, okay, it's beautiful. Why do we have the shared consciousness? And I'm sorry if I'm interrupting you. Don't lose your train of thought. But that's my deep dive. And I'm always asking, but why is it beautiful? And why do we all have the shared shared sense of beauty without having ever gone to beauty school? You know, it's all inside of all of us. But anyway, but please go on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a fascinating question. So we recently did a study, and I have to be really careful with this because it's not published. We haven't written up. It's just one study. Then we're sort of continuing to do more studies. But what we were looking at is across several plausible awe stimuli. Panoramic views, paintings, a picture of a dancer flying through the air, all kinds of different stuff, right? We showed people the picture and then said, okay, how strongly do you feel different emotions in response to this? Because we didn't want to prime awe too strongly, right? And then we also asked people to rate the qualities of that image, things like how extraordinary is it? How simple is it? How beautiful is it? How novel is it for you, right? We call these appraisal dimensions. So ways that you interpret the meaning of what you're seeing or adjectives that you would ascribe to what you're seeing. And we just asked the question, which of those adjectives was most highly correlated with reports of awe? And it turns out that I was expecting the most consistent predictor to be extraordinary or vast or large, right? And those were really strong predictors. But actually, the most consistent one was beautiful, which is in and of itself fascinating because both philosophers and psychologists have been struggling with this question of what is beauty, in the philosopher's case for many centuries and psychologist's case more recently. And what's interesting about this is that when you look at least the empirical data on beauty, the elements that have been investigated and have impact often have something to do with environments in which humans thrive. So for example, the colors of green and blue, right, healthy plant life and water, are considered very aesthetically pleasing in most cultures around the world. There's decent evidence on that, right? There are certain kinds of physical natural environments that correspond to, in the ancient human world, resource-rich environments, right, where there's likely to be food and water. And then you get beyond that, and there are certain properties of symmetry. So, for example, symmetry is typically considered more beautiful than asymmetry. There are exceptions to that, right? So I'm half Japanese, and in Japanese culture, there's aspects of asymmetry that are considered beautiful as well. And flaws are considered beautiful, right? And the healing of flaws through a way that you can still see the flaw, but you've healed it, is considered really beautiful, right? So there are definitely culturally variable elements of this as well. But when we talk about symmetry, there's evidence that both in material aesthetic objects and in human faces and bodies, symmetry is a property that is considered beautiful. And one plausible explanation for that is that symmetry is to some extent associated with genetic and physical health. And so, you know, so beauty in coloring in terms of not like black white coloring, but in terms of flushing, right? Signs of health in hair, signs of health are considered beautiful. So on one hand, we have some evidence that there are certain very somewhat superficial qualities, stimulus properties that are considered beautiful. And yet there's still something beyond that that we haven't figured out how to put our finger on yet, that I think is really the thing that people are talking about when they talk about awe-eliciting stimuli being beautiful. And that's going to be a fun one to track down, right?
It's exactly what I think about all the time. I mean, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm just someone who's trying to turn people on. And like, what is it that turns you on? What is it about a time-lapse flower opening? And, you know, so it's like you're always trying to share that emotion with other people, you know, is what I'm trying to do. And I'm always exploring that. So like, I feel like I'm studying beauty all the time. It's beyond, like I say, the superficial thing. It's a rose. It's like, what is it about red energy? And I love what you said. It does relate to your, you know, ancestral survival, that the turquoise water means life, and this would be a good place where I could live and all that cool stuff. And so the combination of knowing that is awesome, combined with, and I'm going to share with you and the universe, take it a step further. Take it a step further to where, what is it about turquoise, that wavelength of color, that is activating you in a way, and just feel it and get one with it. And it's the turquoise, it's the ripple on the water. These are fingerprints of the universe. And so what you're doing, I feel, is like you're letting go and you're being one with it all, not too different from a psychedelic journey, I would say, in a similar way, you know, making you ultimately present and seeing, you know, beyond the superficial level. You know, I directed commercials for like 12 years, and beauty, I think a lot of people believe, is like what Madison Avenue or social says, which is BS. We don't know. However, there's a ton of like artistry and science and media research data. Like, what is it about this particular person or color, you know, that'll help sell a product, you know? and they dial it in for every country and every culture, and it's all done with a tremendous amount of data research, you know, marketing and advertising is what it's called. All designed to press your button, all designed to hit an emotion and say, it's because every commercial is beautiful. It is done by artists. You know, it isn't done by some bean counter. And these artists get paid the greatest amount of money. They were the top of the creme de la creme. And now with the power of social and this whole digital screen universe we're living in, Instagram, whatever, you're getting these like ads all the time. And they're using beauty, true? They're using beauty to train, manipulate you. So maybe we got to be more beauty literally conscious, or, you know, like, how are you being manipulated? Just like you have to be conscious when the press manipulates you. A newspaper isn't always factual. The TV news isn't always 100% accurate. If you think beauty is what's being projected as a product seller, right, then it's like you got to go into the spiritual side of it.
I think what I would advocate for actually is a really valuable part of critical thinking training is knowing how your emotions influence how you process information. So I'm not sure I would agree that every advertisement, TV advertisement, news, you know, sort of news media article is necessarily beautiful, but it's trying very hard to engage our emotions. And the data behind this are quite clear, right? So when we're experiencing a pleasant emotion, we have a more lenient and positive evaluation of whatever it is that we're looking at. So if a store can get us in a good mood and feel cheerful and welcome, if a commercial can associate pleasant affect with that product, our evaluation of that product is likely to go up, especially if we're not thinking too critically about it, which we're not most of the time, let's be honest. If we are thinking critically about it, that could even backfire. But most of the time we're not, right? Most of the time we're talking about pizza or beer. You know, who cares which brand? I care which brand. But, you know, if it's not a decision of consequence, like which paper towels am I going to buy, then the influence of that momentary pleasant affect being associated with it can be relatively potent. Anger is also fun. It's just fun. Like, let's be honest, people are really enjoying anger right now in the sense that it's very motivating. It is a self-positive, right? When you are angry, your sense of self-value and self-worth and the value of your opinions and your perspective goes up. And it's certainly a lot better than being sad or shamed. And so a lot of us are spending a lot of time angry, I think, because it's more fun than the alternative. But what strikes me about these moments of beauty and what might tie together a lot of the experiences that we're talking about is psychological absorption. When I evaluate any art product and when I tell you I love this song, movie, TV show, novel, whatever it is, I'm actually pretty agnostic to genre, which people give me crap about because I really love disco, right? I mean, but I have very widespread tastes in all of those media.
Dawn Summer, I love her.
She's fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah. Yep.
But what I'm really looking for, whether it's disco or country or hip hop, is to be transported. I want to be immersed in a moment in time and space and human experience that tells me someone else's story effectively. And for me, the essence of beauty is being so captured by whatever it is that I'm engaging with that my whole mind is in that for that period of time and not on my to-do list. And there are lots of ways to get there. And I think that it would behoove us as scientists, now I'm going to put my scientist hat on, right? And say, I think that we could stand to learn carefully a lot more about what the characteristics are of stimuli that do that for us. Because we're guessing right now. We don't know. We're guessing. Good reasons for those guesses. But we don't actually have data.
But that's why I brought up the whole thing, even the old-fashioned thing of, you know, making commercials. It was all about, you know, manipulation of your behavior with the use of beauty, clearly. You know, I mean, even the crummiest, you know, news show, whatever, I mean, they have beautiful, they have good lighting. You know, people are understanding that even Instagram or, you know, bloggers are doing work that was like feature film quality. And that doesn't happen by accident. You know, people are aware. Good lighting. The podcast we're doing, we hope it looks good. Right? It didn't just fall off the back of a truck. So, you know, that's what's really cool. And I'm just alerting everybody, like, in a way, it's a warning. Just be more visually literate. Be aware of, you know, when your buttons are being pressed, which is obvious when you get like a crappy commercial thrown at you. It's very obvious. But
and I'm thoroughly literate. Listen to, there's a reason they throw music into everything, right? So there's that as well. It's often being used to kind of nudge your emotions.
The whole messaging campaign, you know, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Again, on a commercial, they hire the best composers. Mm-hmm. They hire the best musicians. Mm-hmm. True? Mm-hmm. So tell me, from your experience, because I know you're involved with dance and music, mm-hmm. how is that your gateway, your portal into feeling of wonder and awe?
There are several. And so there is seeing a new story or hearing a new story and the potential for awe in being granted a moment in someone else's life richly. If it's done well, you can smell, you can feel that moment of someone else's experience and live in it, even if it's for just a couple of minutes. So there's that level. There's the level of appreciating technical expertise. So my husband and I last night went to the San Francisco Ballet Gala, which is an absolutely beautiful experience. And as part of that, there's a performance, and that performance included brief snippets of several pieces that's like a coming attractions for the season of ballet that's just ahead. And there were several awe moments, but one in particular, one dancer did something, and I've been dancing for decades. I've been seeing beautiful, extraordinary performances for many, many, many years. This dancer did something that I did not know that you could do with the human body. It was really quite amazing. So there's level of technical performance. And in some ways that's enhanced when you understand the genre well enough to know how difficult that was and to know how groundbreaking that was. There's that level. And then there's, in both music and dance, there's pattern and the possibility of elements presented first separately and then being combined in increasingly complicated ways that, again, really captures your attention and forces you to pay attention to what you're experiencing in the moment. And pushes those boundaries. And that is those three different layers of opportunity to experience awe, in addition to all the other emotions that we can experience, right? Awe is not the only emotion that we experience in response to the arts. We can experience love and grief and joy and humor and all of that as well. But awe is likely to come from one of those three. And I dig all of them, right? They're all there. But one thing that's cool about that is that in each of those cases, knowledge actually increases the awe proneness. And one of the things that we're wrestling with as a field right now is that we've built ourselves into a corner a little bit by defining awe as a response to the extraordinary, as the response to something that we've never encountered before and can't comprehend. And what's really interesting about this is that there are plenty of examples that counter that that we can't quite explain yet. So for example, sunsets, right? I've seen so many sunsets. I live in Arizona. We have incredible sunsets on a regular basis. And yet I can be walking to my car at night and still be enraptured to the point of freezing and standing still to gaze at this sky, despite having seen thousands and thousands of sunsets, despite knowing perfectly well the physics of how sunsets are created. That's not a mystery to me. What is the mystery? What is it? I don't know. And we don't actually have data to answer that question. I can guess. And my guess might be, again, that momentary reminder, that capture of my mind, pulling it outside of myself, outside of my individual life, and reminding me of greatness for just a moment. I think that might be what that is. But what we're really starting to have fun with, some of my students and some colleagues and I, is this idea that sometimes knowing more about a domain might actually increase your awe response to it.
Might increase your what?
Your awe response, right? That if you, especially in the domain of the arts, but also in the domains where physics is relevant, where language is relevant, where knowledge of people and how people work is relevant, in some ways, knowing more might actually help you appreciate greatness and novelty when you see it. And we kind of want to get into that, because if we understand that process better, we may be able to help people increase their experience of awe in ways that are somewhere in between what we have now, which is either go to the Grand Canyon, right? You can't do that. Like pop up after work, most of us, and go to the Grand Canyon, or take a walk down the street and find something that surprises you. That last introduction, that last is great, but even that's only going to go so far. And so I'm wondering if we can find a middle ground that exploits this opportunity to learn in a domain, and through that learning, actually open ourselves up to more experiences of the extraordinary that we simply wouldn't have recognized otherwise or wouldn't have perceived.
That's what I try to do with my films. I mean, with Fantastic Fungi, you know, it opens up, you know, it talks about the science that, you know, fungi can create soil, you know, it's the ecosystem of the planet. It's how, and then we have, you know, like scientists like Suzanne Smart, who did the studies and showed that there's a mother tree that, you know, takes care of its young, which is like the inspiration for Avatar, which captures the, you know, cultural imagination. But combining that with the time lapse and the, you know, macro cinematography, when you had the academic science initially, and then you can like let go and go, God, my God, it's all so beautiful. Why is that time lapse shot of a mushroom growing in front of me so engaging? Like I could look at 100 of them in a row and probably not get bored.
So what do you mean by beautiful? What you use the word beautiful again. What does that mean in that context?
I think it's something that you went to the edge on that engages you and puts you in front of the great mystery, you know, and I'm just enraptured in it. So it's possible you don't have to go further. You're in the rapture, you know, and like, so what is that? This is like, they're always asking why, like an annoying 4-year-old, you know? So it's like, it's either you stop there, and I think that, see, that's also where people, it's about the biggest question of all, fear of dying, because you kind of want to know what is the great beyond, and if you can let go that it's a mystery, which I'm leaning into, and I'm okay with that, and I'm tiny, you know, like that sense of wonder and awe, I'm a fractional speck in this grand universe. If I'm okay with that, that is the loss of fear of dying. Or you need to have a story for some people who can't handle the fact that you don't know, that there isn't an answer. So whether it's heaven and hell and what other story you come up with, because I mean, don't you agree in psychology, most people believe that that's like the ultimate question that people struggle with is what happens to you when you die?
Yeah, I think we do a pretty good job of protecting ourselves from it. But there is actually a branch of social psychology called terror management theory that's actually exactly about that. It's investigate the various psychological mechanisms and processes that we use to kind of deal with that. Right, to cope with that knowledge that we are in fact mortal.
That's a big one. So anyways, so you asked me the question, like, what is beauty? I think beauty takes you to the edge of the cliff, to where you're kind of wrestling with the biggest question of all: who am I, what am I in this grand universe? Because it did stop that functional brain of yours for a moment. You're looking at the sunset sky in Arizona. You know, you're finally, like, you know, part of this grand experience of energy, and you realize it's all energy, and that is kind of mind blowing. And again, the scientists can tell you what, like, everything is wavelengths, and it's all energy from the physics of it. But and what I enjoy doing is taking it to the edge, I think, and just soaking it up. And maybe that's what we don't do enough of. So you take it to the edge of you're enraptured in the beauty, but we all kind of move on to the next thing. I mean, isn't it true that the brain dwells more on the negative? And, and when a good thing happens, we spend a fractional amount of time moving on to problem solving, moving on to putting out a fire. Oh, guess what? My daughter just got an award for something she did. Oh, cool. Boom, hang up, moving on, Right? It's kind of like we don't savor it, right? It's not part of our survival mode. Well, you know more about that than I do.
Well, yes, there is certainly, we call it a negativity bias, where there appears to be selective memory, selective attention, selective processing toward negative, at least dangerous or threatening stimuli relative to positive ones. I think that is certainly true, and there are a number of mechanisms that produce that, ranging from the speed at which we can fear condition, right? Learn to fear new, even really simple stimuli if they've been paired with an electric shock, to the reason why I couldn't smell tequila for 10 years, right? Because after a single experience of nausea following eating some food, right?
Michelle, I think that's what we're trying to do with the gratitude film, for example. Like, okay, so if the brain naturally veers off to fear and survival naturally because of the reptilian part of our past and all of that, then one way to stop maybe the negative spiral is to take a moment to think of anything that you can be grateful for. Anything. Like, I'm breathing, I got fingers, I'm a beautiful tree. There's always something you can pull out to be grateful for. And if it slows down that negative spiral for a beat, then maybe I feel like it's a really good first step in the right direction. Not as like the answer, but to go from, again, soaking up that feeling of beauty and wonder to, as a counter to being, stuck in the rat race of fear.
I might reframe that a little bit. The negativity bias is very real. There's ample evidence in a number of ways for it. Sometimes the thing that I think that we get most stuck in is not so much fear as complacency, combined with, especially in the modern environment, just get it done, just constantly getting it done. But that complacency of mind, of being in our mental comfort zone, I think that may be a particular trap right now. And it's a trap that's fed by our own inclinations to not change anything that ain't broken, right? Combined with a media environment that is designed to show us exactly what we want to see without challenging. And you and I are both awe junkies and lovers, right? So this is an experience. This sense of unsettling and destabilizing is fun. It's a perspective that's certainly common to artists, and it's not uncommon among scientists either, but it's not necessarily representative of humanity. So friend and colleague Piercarlo Valdesolo and Jesse Graham did a series of studies where they looked at the implications of experimentally elicited awe for how comfortable people were with ambiguity. And what I had found in a previous study was that at the dispositional level, people like you and me who are super awe prone, who like awe, who seek out awe, who experience it a lot, we report this, there are different terms for it because like different people develop different scales, but we are very comfortable with lack of knowledge. We are comfortable with being that on that edge of beyond this, I don't understand. And that feels good. That's cool. Or, hey, life is really ambiguous. This is not a question that has a definitive answer. That's a comfortable space for us. Not everybody's there. And people who are less awe prone are not so much there. What Carlo and Jesse found is that when you experimentally put people into an awe space through video, right, through photographs that are awe eliciting, the first thing that happens is that their comfort with ambiguity goes down. They're like, hold on a second. I don't like this so much. And the next thing that happens is an attempt to ascribe uncertainty to some conscious agent. And that conscious agent can be God. It can be a computer algorithm. You can decide it. That's not conscious, is stretching that, right? But it can be, oh, somebody programmed this. This was going to happen this way. But there's something on average in people that actually reacts to the unknown by going, I need an explanation for this. I'm not comfortable sitting with the lack of explanation for this. And so, yeah, there's so much that we don't know. I really aspire to being humble as a scientist and acknowledge, especially within awe, that if awe is this big, right, as a phenomenon, we know about this much about it, and there's all this other stuff that we don't understand yet. But I think that one of those is how we can default to experiencing awe as so pleasurable. Clearly, we seek it out. We create stimuli and objects and works of art and architecture. Awe-inspiring places, panoramic, large, right, views, locations are holy places, right? Many parts of the world. Clearly there's something about this, right, that we're seeking out. And yet there's also something about it that demonstrably makes people a little uncomfortable. And so understanding that interplay, I think, is important for appreciating both when and how awe stimuli and awe interventions can be used to facilitate well-being, but also to understand how the human mind deals with not knowing.
So Michelle, thank you so much. I can't believe how deep of a journey we went on at the intersection between, I think, art and science. It's really remarkable that you actually have a deep experience and, you know, connection to both art and science, and to be able to be, I feel like a fellow astral kindred spirit, to be traveling on the pathway to understanding what is wonder and awe. What does it mean to stand on the edge of the cliff and look at that giant landscape, which makes you feel like a fraction in the universe, and just soak it up and have it feed your soul.
Thank you so much, Louis. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Okay. All right. Take care. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.